So tonight I'm going to be talking about art and the spiritual life. And this, the reason I'm talking about this is that it, well, this movement, Tree Ratna, that we are part of, this centre is a mark of the Tree Ratna movement, it arose out of a vision. It arose out of the creative mind of Sangharashtra. So it arose as Sangharashtra was developing his teachings and his experience. And this particular emphasis on the arts came out of his struggle to integrate two very distinct parts of his being. This is his, he describes them in his autobiography as one side was the scholar, the ascetic scholar. On the other side, there was this part of him which is more of a kind of a languishing poet. So, and these two parts of his experience, he was really tussling with how to hold these two parts of himself as he progressed in his spiritual development. Fortunately, one of his early teachers encouraged him to not abandon his poetry and to see poetry as part, a key element of his reflective practice. So this beginning of the poet and the scholar was pivotal in the development of his ideas that he laid out in his long essay called The Religion of Art. And in it he advocates engagement with the arts as a means to refine and expand consciousness and to help establish conditions to know truth directly, unmediated by our rational mind. So in the essay he develops an argument that establishes a correlation between beauty and truth. And from that deduces that therefore the arts that embody the beautiful have the potential to guide us towards a direct experience of truth. The Buddha stated that everything proceeds from mind, so our mental states completely define how we know and interact with our lives. This then is the distinct aspect of spiritual practice that Sangharakshita is suggesting that we can usually usefully pay attention to bring attention to what we colour our mind with, to really investigate the views that proliferate around bare sensation. And in this way, the religion of art can be read as a reflection on the potential beneficial influence of the arts on consciousness. And this is primarily concerned in the text. The text primarily is concerned with looking at the arts from the position of being an observer or a consumer of art. Sangharakshita in this and other writings places great emphasis on the creative mind. And tonight I'm actually going to be spending time looking at the qualities of the artist's mind that gives rise to art and suggesting that engaging with the Dharma, engaging with practice, with the spirit of the artist might be a fruitful way to proceed. But before I go into the qualities of the artistic mind, I just really want to encourage you to track down a copy of The Religion of Art. One aspect of it that I think is really useful is that within it, Sangharakshita has much to say on the nature of religion and the religious mind. And he describes the qualities of the religious mind being primarily a fearless state that arises as a consequence of letting go of ego. Letting go of attachment and desire. Letting go of being fixed in a particular mode of being. And ultimately, he sees the spiritual life being complete freeing ourselves from the limitations of the notion of separate selfhood. And this is one of the key teachings of the Buddha and a key to understanding the process of spiritual maturation. In the text, Sangharakshita weaves these very key teachings of the Dharma with the arts into a single thread, and it's this thread I'm going to be trying to draw on this evening. So David Jones, who was a mid-20th century painter, artist, he wrote that humans are distinctive in nature because we are makers. So that's not just in the sense that spiders make webs or birds make nests, but that we create as an act of recollection, of representing or recalling that which is significant, the sacredness of life that we find ourselves within. This view that makes us that making is distinctly human, and there is a correlation between the spiritual life and the life of the artist, I find this really important. But it could be easily dismissed if we imagine that, well, we're not very artistic, so where does this fit in with our own practice, with our own life? And in answer to that, I just want to tell you about a recent experience. So I was in an airport, noticing how everybody seemed to be walking around with a unique suitcase. And it's quite amazing that although suitcases are mass-produced, in this whole airport, I couldn't find a single person walking around with the same suitcase. And this reminded me of Robert Bly. Robert Bly talks about the sacks that we each carry over on our shoulders. And in them, we gather all the experiences that define our sense of self and world. He suggested that our suitcases, rucksacks or shoulder bags are filled with memories, experiences and habits, and all this we carry from place to place to reconstitute, to re-know who we sense we are, who we believe we are, and the world that we exist within. So each one of us has our own unique suitcase, and the contents are all stories. Every one of us has a suitcase of stories. So in this sense, we're all carrying around works of art. Works of art that we've created. Each of us has a unique suitcase full of stories. So we're all story makers, and each one of us tonight will be sitting here with a unique response to what I'm saying and recreating a story around bare perception. So this is my response if you say I'm not artistic. We fill the suitcases of the body and the heart with stories, and we fill the mind with views and judgments. Every one of our senses is being coloured, even defined by our artistic creations. And now, here, we've met the Dharma. And we've been offered maps and methods to explore what it is to be human. And these reveal that it's not enough just to be an artist. An artist tends to be bound by culture or personal bias. But here we're offered a larger framework into which we can consciously place our creativity, our stories. And I think it's this that makes Sangharakshita's emphasis on the arts so useful and distinctive. Sangharakshita weaves the artist and the spiritual aspirant into one, and through that there's an implicit encouragement to bring the contents of our suitcase, our stories, into the light of the Dharma. By being with this in this way, we can live the life that wants to move through us. We can live the life that wants to live amongst us. Because by freeing, investigating ourselves, the contents of our suitcases, it really allows us to be more responsive, more fluid, more in accord with reality. So what I'm going to do tonight for the remainder of this talk is look at three aspects associated with the artist. I'm going to look at the attributes of curiosity, imagination, and playfulness. So the numerous practices, concepts, and rituals of Buddhism, they spring from a curiosity, an interest in the raw materials of life. This was and is the path of the Buddha, investigating, being with, turning towards experience. This is what he did beneath the Bodhi tree. This was simply sitting in northern India beneath a tree with curiosity about what is actually arising in experience. And this curiosity we describe as mindfulness. The art of curiosity begins to help us notice the subtle and not so subtle sense impressions of the body and of the mind, and gradually the interpretations, the stories that we're overlaying onto these bare sensations also begin to become visible to us. It's as if the suitcase that we've been dragging around with us begins to reveal its contents. We begin to notice that a lot of the time we're acting out of our stories. We're filtering the wealth of sensation experience to make it fit our views, to fit our judgments. And this beginning of self-knowledge can be really uncomfortable. But this uncomfortableness, this discomfort, is actually the outcome of the Dharma beginning to bite. The Dharma is beginning to impact on our very being, because it's beginning to disturb the contents of our suitcase. And my experience is that it's at this point, unfortunately, that many people fall away from Buddhist practice. Those of us who remain, I would say, have a quality of fearlessness. So each one of us who is sitting here must have, to some extent, mastered the fear that arises when we realise that our practice is changing our life. When we begin to see that to go further, we're going to have to let go of some control, to let go of trying to predetermine what is arising in us and in others. So the fearlessness of the practice of curiosity comes about because we don't, within curiosity, we don't have an agenda. Acquisition and judgment are secondary responses to the kind of objects that arise in curiosity. So part of deepening practice is finding the art of turning towards without becoming lost or over-identified with what is becoming visible to us. And the Buddha describes it in this way. Monk, on seeing a visible object with the eye, does not grasp at its major signs or secondary characteristics, because greed and sorrow, evil, unskilled states, would overwhelm him if he dwelt leaving this eye faculty unguarded. So he practices guarding it. He protects the eye faculty, develops restraint of the eye faculty. And on hearing a sound with the ear, or smelling an odour with the nose, or tasting a flavour with the tongue, on feeling an object with the body, or thinking a thought with the mind, he experiences within himself the blameless bliss that comes from maintaining this Aryan guarding of the faculties. In this way, a monk is a guardian of the sense doors. So guarding the sense doors, the sense faculties, this might suggest that we should limit or even imprison our senses. But really what we're being asked to do is simply to guard the senses against grasping. either by trying to prolong or heighten a particular sense experience, maybe giving it significance or a particular meaning, maybe judging it or trying to diminish or suppress the experience. The Buddha tells us that greed and sorrow will be the outcome of any of the numerous ways we try to grip or resist experience. So this reminds me of the poet Keats, who describes his experience of setting up the conditions for a poem to arise as the art of negative capability. So that's the capability to not know, to really bear not knowing, to remain in an open state of curiosity and allow us ourselves to be carried through this negative capability, to be carried deeper into the mystery of finding ourselves in this human life. And the Buddha tells us that experiencing our life without grasping naturally gives rise to blameless bliss. Now, Keats contracted tuberculosis, and after a long illness, he died really horribly at the age of 26. So I just mention this to say that, well, we may experience blameless bliss by not grasping or resisting experience, but this is not somehow that we become exempt from pain. Part of the package of being human is this mixture of pain and pleasure. This is what we work with. It's more that we develop the capacity to have less need to push and pull at these changing bodily experience, body sensations, our emotions or our thoughts. We develop the ability to be with pain, and for some of us more significantly, we become able to bear pleasure. And both of these poles come by developing the ability to remain curious, developing the art of curiosity. So it's as if the artist's way of curiosity is supported by the ability to not know, to not understand. And this becomes a really powerful support to begin to be with the arising experiences that are emerging through our life. Ultimately, we're unpacking a suitcase. Ultimately, we're putting that suitcase down altogether. Because curiosity, what it's moving towards, is the liberation of the individual. And one key thing that we can be curious about is, what is this sense of self, this quality of feeling ourselves being in some way a separate being, a separate individual? That this suitcase of views and memories is bolstering, is recreating. What is it that is being liberated? How real is it? And if we can become really curious about this sense of self, we discover that it's ungraspable. It's always transient. This sense of self is said to be like a dream or a reflection in a mirror. It appears real in this moment. But as conditions change, so does our sense of self. In this Sangha, we're really fortunate to have Sangharakshita as our teacher, because one of the distinct emphases of this, of his thinking, of his vision, is the emphasis on the ecumenical. That is the drawing together of the various schools and developments of Buddhism into a single tradition. And I say I feel it's very important, because the longer that we remain curious about the sense of self, this carries us into what is described as the Mahayana approach to practice. It is said that this tradition, the Mahayana, is a distinct development within the history of Buddhism, and it arises out of seeing deeply into the limitations created by believing that the culmination of the spiritual life is personal liberation. The obvious question that arose in people's practices, early Buddhist practice, arose is, if selfhood is illusory, what gets liberated? And this led to practices being seen to take place within and for the whole interconnected web of humanity. So practice begins what we describe as our self, but it takes place, our practice actually takes place in this larger arena of the whole of life. So the Mahayana recognizes that we are all utterly interconnected with each other, with life as a whole. So it expands our practice to see that it has to include and is for the benefit of all beings. This is the vision of the Buddha land that we've been pursuing all year in various ways at this very class. How can we create the environment that is for the benefit of all? And this is why in Tri Ratna there's an emphasis on friendship. Because Sangha is mutual practice for the benefit of all. This is really the meaning of Sangha. To really approach and broaden into what this means for how we live our life, to be able to respond to this, to respond to the fact that we find ourselves in this precious life, but without anything which is fixed or permanent at our core, is key to practice. And to begin to open into the world and to each other in this way, out of this ground of curiosity, requires the second aspect of the artist's sensibility, which is that of imagination. So to really be able to see the world and ourselves as a conjured story is an act of imagination. To move beyond the literal level of our experience and find meaning and value in the drama of this life is an act of imagination. And to release into interconnectedness, to really challenge the boundaries of who we believe we are, is an act of imagination. Stephen Batchelor, a Buddhist scholar, went on to say that it's only through imagination that we can make any use of the Dharma. The Dharma cannot come alive until we allow imagination to remake it, that is, to connect our lived experiences to the teachings. And we do that in the arena of the imagination. And this is the way of the artist, to learn from reverie and reflection in this world of imagination, to respond creatively, to read through our imagination that all appear, everything that appears before and within us, in this level of significance, of meaning. So through imagination, we feel our way towards some direct knowing. We use an imagination as a bridge into the mystery of the Dharma. And the bridge of imagination is particularly vital when we begin to open to the Dharma that directly addresses the nature of selfhood through the teachings of emptiness that are the central expression and foundation of the Mahayana schools of Buddhism. Because of Sangharakshita's vision, sitting within the sevenfold puja, as you'll know, we have the Heart Sutra, this kind of pith teaching on emptiness. And here's a section from it. Form is only emptiness, emptiness only form. Feeling, thought and choice, consciousness itself are the same as this. All things are by nature void, not born or destroyed, nor are they stained or pure, nor do they wax or wane. see the connection between what I've written next and what I've just spoken about. Just bear with me. Okay, I think I'm just going to carry on. So this move of the imagination and this correlation between imagination and actually being able to face the teachings of the Heart Sutra, what we really discover is that our practice begins to develop so that it's not so much a practice that is purely this kind of inner experience that we describe as me, as ourself, but actually that we discover that our practice is known through our ongoing meetings with others. Our spiritual life is known in this space that actually exists between each one of us. Yeah, actually this is, and that space is utterly mysterious, unknowable, ungraspable. We can feel this kind of the kind of physical space, but it's also in the meeting there is a third element that seems to come alive in that dialogue, in that communication. And what is that? This is for me, that's the mystery that is pointed to through the Heart Sutra. So in shops, at work, in bed, sitting around a table, this is the significance and the fruit of spiritual practice arise in these pregnant spaces between people. The spiritual life is to see and be seen, to respond, to simply be with each other. So we still have this sense of personal internal practice, but it's really tested and deepened by being in association with others. And this real acknowledgement of this space that opens between us, amongst us, leads us deeper into the mystery. We begin to see that not only are our suitcases of selfhood illusory, but the whole airport and all the beings within it with their own suitcases are also illusory. That all life is far more unknowable and mysterious than perhaps we had thought. So to really open into this world, it does require the fruits of curiosity, and it requires imagination. The seventh Dalai Lama said, "Dream objects in the mind of one drunk with sleep. Horses and elephants conjured by a magician, only appearances. On those foundations, nothing real, merely mental imputations. Similarly, all things in the world and beyond are simply projections of names and thoughts. Not even the tiniest atom exists by itself, independently and in its own right." So this gives this vision that we do not exist independently. We can really look at this at a very simple, practical level, that we are utterly connected. Our food, transport, literature, the carpet we're sitting on, the space, these are all constructs that have been collectively created. And everything that we see and know is in a flux of change, arising and decaying. So this is where we move towards by engaging with curiosity and then really bringing imagination to what we find in experience. And now I'm going to say a bit about the last aspect, which is play. Now, Sangharakshita has some really interesting things to say about play, particularly in a chapter called The Greater Mandala, which is going to be the theme for the urban retreat later in, on, I think in a couple of months' time,
21st of November.
21st of November. There'll be plenty of opportunity to look at the Greater Mandala. And this comes, he's talking about the wisdom texts and the Heart Sutra being one of them. And in this chapter on the Greater Mandala, one of the things that he says is that spiritual life is thought of as a leela, or the play, the game. It's a purely spontaneous welling up of spiritual energy. That is a way purposeless. Yes, that's it. He also says that the fine arts are called leela kala, that is, the playful arts, because they have no earthly use. I really like that. That actually, it's quite a challenging statement, really. But actually, their value is in the very fact that they are useless. And what he means by that is non-functional, in the sense that we can't pin them down and control how they operate in the world. So we have curiosity, we have imagination, and now I'm suggesting we really need play. Because play helps us engage in the world in a very direct way. To play suggests those childlike qualities of immediacy, of directness, but also the ability to be fully in our experience. There's also a sense of play, something around spontaneous delight in that which draws our curiosity. The texture and feel of paving or grass or skin, the smell of leaves, of rain, of closed rooms, of newsprint. When we play, we relax, we let go, we open. So play carries us into the wisdom that can see through the illusion of self and other, but also the illusion that enlightenment is somewhere else. The trees are just singing in their utter treeness, and the cup sits precisely on a table next to a sheet of lined paper. And on it's written, play sees that all appearances are a display, a dance, a delightful and terrible play of reality, everything arising and returning, dependent upon conditions, displaying utter suchness, the pristine exactness and purity of each taste, touch, sign, sound, smell and thought are inseparable from the ground of clarity and openness. So this vision carries practice further. Curiosity breaks down the belief in separate permanent selfhood, and imagination breaks through the belief. I've just found the page. The belief that there can be a distinction between ourselves and the world. So we end up simply playing, because even the distinction between enlightenment and non-enlightenment is seen to be illusory. Everything we see and know is simply flowering in a vast open field of clarity. Every flowering manifesting its utter unique expression of the open ground out of which it arises. This is the Vajrayana. This is the last flowering of Buddhist practice, epitomized by Padmasambhava, the great teacher of Tibet that Jivalamani introduced us to a few weeks ago. I'm just going to read something from actually another Tibetan teacher, Longchenpa. At that time, whilst mind is like the sky, no object is postulated, no propositions entertained. There's nothing to be cultivated and no one to cultivate something. There's nothing to be created and no one creating. No apprehendable object is found. Rather, what is there is like the reflection of the moon in water or a mirage. If you've crossed the three worlds of your fictions by this boat of a holistic experience that is so vast in the absence of a demanding subject, you have come to the sphere that is complete in and by itself. So it's here that the artist plays, enjoying, fully at ease, responding and simply being, ever curious, ever creative, living out of and within imagination, playing in the ever-changing dance of reality. So this is the spirit of the artistic life. And this is the art of the spiritual life.